Hello, everyone. I know people are still filing in and getting lunch, but I'm going to go ahead and get started with the introductions, and feel free to continue to work your way through the line and get your food. My name is Joe Vukovic. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Northeast Midwest Institute and with our Mississippi River Basin program. And before we get started today, there's a round of thanks that I'd like to offer to everyone. So first, to the offices of Congressman Mike Kelly and Ron Kine for helping us coordinate and host this briefing today. And also MICRA, the Mississippi Interstate Cooperative Resource Association, for working with me to plan this briefing and to provide us with the talented panel of distinguished speakers that we have today, and I'm looking forward to hearing from them. I think we can all appreciate the importance of containing the spread of invasive species like the Asian carp, so I don't want to belabor that point too much. I'd rather leave time for our panel to talk to you about that. So I'll just move on to the introductions, and then we'll hear from our panel. So we have with us today Aaron Wolt from the Fish and Wildlife Service, Nick Fronauer from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Ron Brooks from the Kentucky Fish and Wildlife Resources Department, and also the chair of MICRA, Andre Ragu, CEO of Moon River Foods and Blue Shorts Fishery, and Greg Conover, the MICRA coordinator. We've left plenty of time for questions and answers after the panel, and in addition to the panelists that we have with us up here, we have representatives from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Geological Survey. So without any more delay, I'll just pass it on to our panel. Thanks.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for coming, and thank you for not laughing at all of us as we shuffle around up here trying to figure out how we're going to get from there to here to be part of the panel. So thank you in advance for that. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. So our briefing today is going to highlight the efforts of a collaboration of state, federal, and non-governmental partners working toward the common goal of halting the advance of Asian carps in America's waterways using strategic prevention and control actions. So I'm going to kick this off, and I will start with a brief overview of the national and regional planning efforts. I will cover the direction provided by Congress in 2014 as part of the reauthorized Water Resources Reform and Development Act, or WRDA, and then I'll conclude with an update on Asian carp status and recent accomplishments of all the cooperating agencies. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and our state and federal partners together carry out strategic detection, prevention, and control actions to address the threat of Asian carps in the United States. Over 10 years ago, acknowledging the need for a more coordinated and comprehensive approach to the growing threat of Asian carp, the Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force called for development of a national strategy or plan for implementing coordinated Asian carp prevention actions. So to help address this, the service led the development of the nation's first national Asian carp plan in 2007. Now, the service did that with over 70 state, federal, industry, academic, and non-governmental partners. So it was a big group of people in a room for quite a long time to work on this plan. That plan became known as the Management and Control Plan for Bighead, Black, Grass, and Silver Carps in the United States. And it established 7 common goals that folks could agree to, along with 48 strategies and 113 recommendations, which covered the entire nation. And the overall objective of that plan was eradication of all but triploid Asian carps in the wild. So since then, since that national plan was developed 10 years ago, that plan has served as the foundation for additional geographically focused sub-basin Asian carp strategies, and those include, and you can see some of them on the slide, the Ohio River Basin Asian Carp Control Strategy Framework, the Upper Mississippi River Basin Asian Carp Control Strategy Framework, the Asian Carp Regional Coordinating Committee's Great Lakes Asian Carp Action Plan and Monitoring and Response Plan, individual state response plans. Several states, and I'm not going to list them all, but have individual state plans like Minnesota and Michigan and Illinois, among others. And there are also new plans currently under development in other Mississippi River basins and sub-basins, including the Lower Mississippi River Basin and the Missouri River Basin Plan. So as you can see, with kind of the growing scope of these plans, the geographic coverage of the issue has grown, and these plans are being developed to complement each other and to have partnerships that work together across mainly the Midwestern part of the United States, but a growing swath of the United States. So let's cover WERDA a little bit. So WERDA was reauthorized in June of 2014, and Congress included as part of WERDA specific language directing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to increase interagency coordination in the Upper Mississippi and Ohio River basins. So this included providing leadership on federal and state interagency coordinated actions, strategic planning and technical assistance, and leadership in the development of an annual report to Congress that summarizes Asian carp status, agency actions, and expenditures. So specifically in WERDA, there was a direction for the service to work with all of its partners to submit an annual report to Congress, and again, to lead a collaborative multi-agency effort to slow the spread of Asian carps in the Upper Mississippi River Basin and the Ohio River Basin. In addition, WERDA acknowledges the broad partnership that's involved with Asian carp activities in the United States. So it acknowledges the Department of the Army, with the Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Geological Survey, the National Park Service, and several other federal and state agencies that are involved in this issue. Specifically, in the WERDA report to Congress, which the third annual report was just completed and is being reviewed and finalized and approved through all the layers of approval for actions completed in 2016. But specifically, that report includes these items, and there are five of them. So observed changes in the range of Asian carps, a summary of federal agency and non-federal partner efforts to control the spread of Asian carps, summaries of research that could improve our ability to control the spread of Asian carp, quantitative measures proposed for use to document progress in controlling Asian carp, and a cross-cut accounting of federal and non-federal expenditures, again, in the battle against Asian carp. We have approximately 20 different partner agencies that contribute data for this report, so it's a fairly big undertaking to do annually, but it does come out annually in that third report. It should be available soon. Let's see. So this past year, the state and federal agencies not only continued, but expanded their coordination efforts on key actions to address the highest priority recommendations for work in the Ohio River Basin and the Upper Mississippi River Basin related to Asian carp. Increasing collaboration between the state and federal agencies and with MICRA, who you're going to hear from a little bit later, and other basin organizations and committees has led to an increasingly focused prevention and control suite of actions and control efforts for Asian carp in all of the sub-basin partnerships in 2016 and continuing in 2017. In total, the federal and state agency expenditures for Asian carp management and control actions in the Ohio River Basin and the Upper Mississippi River Basin in FY 2016 was $3.8 million. This is all part of the most recent report. That figure includes expenditures conducted for the purpose, that excludes all of the expenditures conducted for the purposes of Great Lakes protection from Asian carp. That total for the Great Lakes work in the Illinois waterway and the Great Lakes for the Chicago area waterways was an additional $55.2 million. So in total, $59 million, $55.2 for the Great Lakes and Illinois waterway, $3.8 in the Ohio River Basin and the Upper Mississippi River Basin. So activities that were conducted with those funds include monitoring and surveillance, early detection, rapid response, containment and control, harvest and removal, use of deterrence, stakeholder outreach, and law enforcement. You're going to be hearing a lot more about specific accomplishments to support these Asian carp work activities from the rest of the panel as we go on. One of the main goals of this work is to leverage and maximize our return on investment and support a national approach to kind of blend all the efforts that we have going on in these basins and to make use of new tools and technologies that may be developed in one sub-basin that can be used in multiple sub-basins. So that's been a major focus of trying to coordinate all the activities of all the partners and then to leverage what we're learning and the monies that we're spending. So some examples of that are potential new Asian carp deterrents or controls that are under development through the ACRCC's action plan. Those include things like complex sound and carbon dioxide that hopefully in the future can be used in some of these other basins and other key locations within maybe the Ohio River Basin and the Upper Mississippi River Basin. In fact, we had a meeting, and many of the partners met in Springfield, Illinois this past January to kind of discuss some of these ongoing coordination issues and efforts that we could use across the basins. As also part of the Werder report, we look at new information, as I said, on current distribution of Asian carp species. So this is a quick rundown, and I know the maps are hard to see, but we'll go species by species. For silver carp, there were new upstream occurrences in the Ohio River Basin, about a 64-mile expansion of Asian carp, of captures of adult Asian carp. For bighead and grass carp, there were new upstream occurrences in the Minnesota River. There was about a 100-mile jump up the watershed. And for black carp, in 2016, there was no new range expansion. Now, one thing I want to point out about these are only a few individuals that were caught at these upstream locations. It's not full-blown establishment. This is really kind of the leading edge of seeing where some of those very small numbers or small handful of fish are. And the coordinated actions that we're taking as a group are helping us, are allowing us to better monitor and better assess and respond when fish like this are caught. My last slide before I turn it over to Nick from Minnesota DNR is just if you look at the look at more specifically into some of the service funding and to support the Upper Miss and the Ohio River Basin. In FY16, the service provided $1 million for high-priority Asian carp management projects from our base funding. $500,000 of that went to projects in the Upper Mississippi River Basin, and $500,000 of those funds went to projects in the Ohio River Basin. Those projects were prioritized and selected by the micro sub-basins, and then the service passed funding to those agencies to complete those projects. In FY17, we were able to bump that up a little bit and send $1.2 million in service-based funding to some of these high-priority projects, and we hope to be able to continue that work, that funding for those projects in future years. In total, the service, we sent $1.2 million of our $8.4 million budget for FY17 externally to our partners for this high-priority work in the Upper Mississippi River Basin and the Ohio River Basin. And with that, I will turn it over to Nick.
Thank you all. I'm Nick Fronau with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, but today I'm here as a representative for the Upper Mississippi River Collaboration working on this issue. The collaboration involves the five Upper Mississippi states and our federal partners. Just a quick refresher, the Upper Mississippi River Basin starts in the scenic headwaters in Minnesota, working its way down through the lock and dam system into the impounded area all the way down to where the confluence of the Ohio River. It has a lot of state and federal interests in the area. Today, I'll be focusing on the three main projects that our collaboration has been working on since our inception. Their monitoring and assessment, deterrence, and commercial fishing. And while they fall neatly into three categories here, as you see when I go through my presentation, they're quite interconnected and rely on each other. Start out with the monitoring and assessment program. Prior to the collaboration coming together, there were multiple states and universities working out on the landscape to understand what was happening. When the collaboration came together, we were able to combine these efforts, look where the holes were, where we needed to strengthen that, and that's where our federal partners, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Geological Survey, National Park Service, Corps of Engineers, stepped in to help fill that, so we have a full understanding throughout the river system. We monitor all life stages, from egg to larval, to juveniles to adult. It occurs throughout the basin. You'll hear a lot about the Mississippi River main stem, but we're also looking into important tributaries such as the Minnesota River and St. Croix Rivers up in Minnesota to the Des Moines, Skunk, Iowa, Rock, Wapsipinicon, lower down in the system. Monitoring and assessment may not be the sexy project, but it's important. It helps us determine where, when, what tools to employ on the landscape, and it also helps us will help us evaluate how those tools are working when we're implementing them on the landscape. For instance, in the first Werder report, you're probably familiar with this map. This map was put together in 2014-2015 with the best available knowledge. It gives you a quick snapshot of what we knew at the time, but lacks the detail that we might need to make our decisions on the landscape. And through our monitoring program and coming together as a group, we've been able to add that finer detail that we need. establishing, understanding where the reproducing population is occurring, where those single occurrences are, where dams or potential barriers are on the landscape. And we developed these for each of the four species of invasive carp: big head, silver, grass, and black. That naturally stepped into, okay, we understand, what can we do about this? How can we slow, stop, or control them? And the group came together to determine a deterrent strategy. What can we do on the landscape to slow the expansion, both of the reproducing population and these isolated cases that we're catching? And I think one thing became quite clear immediately, that we couldn't stop them at one single point on the river. We determined that we would thus need to come up with an area that we were going to target our efforts at. And these we determined, we call them management zones. And based on our information, we came up with management zones for three out of the four, and we need a little more for the grass carp. For big head and silver, probably the most interest from you guys, we determined from Lock and Dam 14 to 19 would be the management zone, where we would need to employ not just deterrent efforts, but employ other tools such as commercial fishing, the technologies being developed by USGS to combat and slow down these fish. The group also looked at what technologies to use. Oh, stepping back, we also identified it was an important need for the deterrents to contain the fish in these management zones. So we would probably need to employ a deterrent technology at the top, upstream, and the downstream, so that then the efforts can be focused in that middle portion. The group also looked at the technologies that were available, where they were, where the downfalls, what was still needed, information needs, and the steps that would be needed to be taken to put these out there. Valuable stuff that we came up with included information such as challenges, permitting, who would be the sponsors, who would be the leads, and concerns. You know, what were the impacts to the native species? One of the big things, you know, we want to stress is that the stuff that we put out into the system won't have a bigger impact than the actual carp would have on them. We gathered all this information and put it into a final report that is in the review process by the different states and agencies right now and should be out shortly. One of the technologies that the group decided showed the most promise and should be further looked into was acoustic, or sometimes known as complex noise. Carp are known to be sensitive to loud noises and avoid it. The Upper Mississippi sponsored a workshop in 2016 with approximately 75 participants to discuss where the technology was, what we needed to do to further that technology, and what the next steps were. There's a lot of work being done by university and federal agencies on this technology. And recently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has approached the UMR partnership along with the Ohio River Partnership in discussing where we can implement a field trial to evaluate this technology. We're in the beginning process. Talks are still ongoing about where this would be, what the different partners' roles would be, what their responsibilities would be, and who ultimately would help evaluate that technology. As we were developing that deterrent strategy, we recognized that we would also need to bring in other tools, also known as integrated pest management, meaning that we're not going to rely on one certain thing, that we're going to use multiple things to combat the expansion. And that commercial fishing is an important part of this. For the UMR, the commercial fishing has several objectives. It's used extensively in Pool 19 and above to impact reproduction and slow the upstream expansion. Up in Minnesota, we use it to help aid in detection in low-density areas. It's also used to help us determine population sizes in those areas where they're already established.
Where are you going, Ed?
Sorry about that.
Gets you some extra time.
Yeah. You guys
want to die.
I'll just move on and talk. Hopefully it'll come up here shortly. Our commercial fishing effort began in 2015. It started out quite small, and it was a learning process, get somebody out there. As the commercial fishermen are learning, the Illinois system is different from the Mississippi system, which is different from the reservoirs down in Kentucky. So, just getting that commercial angler up and learning the system was important. And we've slowly been ramping it up each year, increasing the effort that's out on the river. In 2017, we've caught over 68,000 pounds of fish so far, and the fall season is yet to come. And again, I'd like to stress that we recognize that this will be an important part of the overall strategy with everything that we're doing. With that, I'll let Ron take over.
Great. Thanks, Nick. Well, this is going to be interesting because everything we do is focused on around our slides. So my name is Ron Brooks. I'm the fisheries director for Kentucky and the MICRA chairman currently. On the first slide, you'll see that we have started our efforts really back in 2012 talking about what we could do to stem the tide of Asian carp moving up the Ohio River. Pennsylvania had an extreme interest in that. And so the RFMT, or the Ohio River Mainstem states, got together and talked about getting some funding from a foundation for 2013 effort. We started some contract commercial fishing on the upper pool. Want me to take over there? Okay. And so that basically what we were trying to do was locate a leading edge. And fortunately, through efforts of MICRA, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and a lot of folks that are representing Congress members out here, word it came through, and by 2015, we were really set up with plans already to move forward on increasing the amount of effort we're putting into keeping these fish from moving up river. See if I can...
Ron, I can feed that down for you if you want to.
Okay. So what we did, we put a plan together, obviously, and that Aaron already talked about, so I won't go into that. But we put a plan together, we got funding for it, and we created a partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and other state agencies to, for the one central goal of keeping the fish from being able to move up the river to the point to where they can become reproductively established in the pools above where what we were calling the leading edge in this case. If you look at the map on here, we got several color zones there. The leading edge that we found in 2013 really was the Greenup Pool. We increased that to the RC Byrd Pool because West Virginia was putting in a lot of effort as well, so we wanted to give them some waters to work with. And the goal there is a lot of heavy monitoring. And then you go below the green area there and you get the rose-colored area. That's what gets most effort in this monitoring and removal or control effort. Starting at McAlpin Pool above McAlpin Lock and Dam there, the lowest dam underneath the rose part. Those fish numbers get gradually decrease as you go up river until you get to Greenup, when we really hardly ever get an Asian carp in the Greenup Pool. That's the way it was in 2013, and quite frankly, that's the way it is today. That's a good sign. That means that probably maybe our efforts are helping, because we had noticed that the Asian carp were starting to move up the river system once they got through the McAlpin Lock and Dam, which seemed to be somewhat of a natural barrier. The yellow part there is what we call a rapid response area. If there is an eDNA detection there, or somebody calls in and says they saw an Asian carp, we will dispatch a staff up there immediately, as will West Virginia and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we'll do our best to confirm them by capturing those fish. Everything below the rose-colored area is really the Badlands. It's full of Asian carp at levels that would rival the Illinois River. So the work we do down there is rather limited, and I'll talk about that in a minute, as well as we do a lot of research in Kentucky and Barkley Lakes. There's a commercial fishery there. as well as we have three producer or processors in Kentucky now. So we augment the commercial fishermen's ability to remove fish from those systems, as well as we're doing some telemetry effort and we're looking at it for berry technology. So when you see these numbers under the monitoring with McAlpin and RC Bird in parentheses there, those are 2016 numbers. You see a lot of effort in electrofishing, you see a lot of effort in gill netting, and you only see less than 50 fish from each method. Those efforts were put in that area in rows through the green areas. In other words, those areas above McAlpin Lock and Dam, where below that there's just tons of Asian carp. Again, those aren't bad numbers. Those are actually pretty good numbers. If we can sustain or even do better than that in terms of getting fewer fish with the same amount of effort or more effort, we know we're doing what we really set out to do, and that is stem the tide of these things becoming reproductively established further up the river. So we'll continue that effort. The control and removal effort occurs in everywhere we go. We always take the fish that we harvest or we catch unless we're going to use them for telemetry. Below the McAlpin Lock and Dam, again, we allow our crews to go down there now. Since 2016, we'd allow them to go down there a few times a year, basically to test their gears. When you're out there day after day after day and not getting any fish, you're beginning to wonder if you're doing the right thing. So we let them go into the areas where there's a lot of fish just so they can see what they're doing is right, and also gives them the ability to tweak what they're doing to make their methodologies better, more efficient. So we do some of that effort. We collected over 20,000 pounds down below McAlpin last year, and we're well ahead of that again this year. We're also looking at that area as potential areas to put commercial fishermen to help the processors get the product they need as well. So when we look at the monitoring of reproduction in this case, really a couple things stand out. We started looking for spawning patches. I think it was like late 2015, early 2016 when we really learned that these things have what's called spawning patches. Asian carp are very aggressive spawners, and so they cause lesions and they cause basically sore looking areas, and those areas are because of their spawning activity. So we look for spawning patches, and we see spawning patches on the fish that we catch really from the Markland or even in the Meldaw pool all the way down through the Cannelton pool. That's not unexpected. If you have enough fish that want to try to spawn, you're going to find spawning patches. A little more disconcerting, I guess, was the fact that we found larval fish and eggs as far as up as the Meldaw pool, which is on the far right there. That's a little higher than I would have expected just because there's so few fish there. And also in the McAlpin pool, which would be a little less unexpected. The good news is, even though we found larval fish there, larval fish being recently hatched fish, you know, they got to survive through that really difficult period of being really small where everything's going to try to eat them until they become juveniles. So they're not really established in the system until they become juveniles. And we haven't found juveniles with all the sampling that we've been doing in that reach from McAlpin Lock and Dam up yet. The smallest fish we have found is we got two fish in 2016 that were around 500 millimeters. And that's iffy when you start talking about juveniles. Telemetry, we have about 142 receivers that cover 500 miles of the river. There's two reasons we're putting receivers out there. One is to look at the scope of movement between pools or among pools, and the other is to look at their use of tributaries. The interpool movement is obvious why we're looking for that. We want to know if these things are trying to move upriver, at what extent are they moving upriver, if they are. And the good news here is that most of the movement that we've been seeing up till now is all downriver movement. We've had one fish move up two pools within the main study area, really nothing of concern. It would be more disconcerting if all of a sudden we're seeing a lot of those fish decide they want to start moving upriver. So that's good news as well. As far as putting them in the tributaries, you know, our folks, the Ohio River is a big river, and the easiest place to catch these fish in the Ohio River is in the tributaries, and they do frequent the tributaries quite often. And so we like to know when and why they're going in there and under what water conditions so we can better target those fish in those areas. We are looking at doing some berry research with the USGS, just as Nick's folks are looking to do up in the Upper Miss. We have about three areas we're looking at right now, and that's below Kentucky and Barkley reservoirs. A lot of fish down there. We have a lot of research going on there. The dam structures are such that they could be considered barriers, and it helps the USGS expand beyond just the pond studies that they've done right now. these areas would only be used for research if it were successful. If it looked like that had utility to use somewhere else, we'd be definitely be interested in moving these things up into the Tennessee River system, where they're trying to keep Asian carp out of very important reservoirs, as well as we'd like to see them put something like that, if it's successful, put on the Ohio River system. McAlpin would be a good place, or potentially Meldal as well. We do have, again, commercial fishing on basically on Kentucky and Barclay that we like to direct the commercial fishing to. We have three Asian carp processors in western Kentucky that are hanging on. They're just not getting enough fish. You can see that the blue line there in for Kentucky and Barclay Lake harvest is kind of exponential increase since 2013. That's because of the processors, and that's because of more focused effort on those lakes. It's over 2 million pounds. We really need that to get quickly over 5 million pounds based on what we're seeing. We do have a research staff on those lakes that are looking at the effects of commercial fishing, as well as looking at efficiencies of the gears. Beyond that, we're also trying to put together a public-private partnership. Some of you that were here last year heard me talk a little bit about that. We are in the stage right now where we believe we're almost ready to do a request for proposals. That partnership will train new fishermen that will work for this new unit. It'll be funded by the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources for at least 2 years. And we hope to get at least 20 new trained fishermen in that unit, as well as a transportation infrastructure where it'll save the commercial fishermen money in trying to move the fish from the lakes to the processors, as well as ensure that the handling of those fish is much better in terms of keeping the fish cold and keeping the quality of the fish up. And talking about processors, we have our main processor in Kentucky right here, our largest processor, and Andre.
Hello, everyone. So today I'm going to talk less about the slides, and I'm going to walk you through probably the biggest question all of you have is why is this company investing in an industry that should be going away, right? Because that's what I would be thinking. And so for the next 7 minutes, I'm going to kind of walk you through the thought process. So right now, Blue Shore Fishery and Moon River Foods, we have probably about $20 million invested in private capital in a capacity of about 25 million fish a year. Right, so it's a substantial investment we've made in what we're calling the new gold, which is Asian carp. And for a lot of the people that, you know, in terms of fishing management or involved in this room in fishing management, we're not naive in our understanding or our let's say, assessment of what the future can look like for this industry. But at the same token, we do understand that there is a viable economic opportunity for the industry as a whole, you know, in the immediate and in the short term. So when we think about generally Asian carp, you know, I think the words that come to mind are things like threats, you know, invaders and invasive. But when we think about American manufacturing, the words that come to mind are things like strength, job creation, opportunity and innovation. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is really how industry is finding innovative approaches to utilize the fish in a way that makes sense for, you know, the communities that need them most. At this moment, we're doing everything from utilizing the fish in terms of processing them into fertilizer so that they can be used for our American farmers. We're using the fish in terms of processing it into waste products that actually go into a lot of our core seafood manufacturing processes, such as crab, lobster, and other sorts of bait fishes. We are even involved now to the point that we've created a lot of infrastructure around the Asian carp, that we're supporting a lot of family and small fisheries that can no longer comply with new FDA requirements, and actually helping them to do a lot of the processing that they've done for the last 70 years or 80 years that they would no longer be able to do because they just don't have the systems or the processes in place. So Asian carp right now for industry really represents a silver lining of revitalization for a freshwater or an inland fishing industry that was pretty much lost, you know. For a lot of people, you know, I always tell the story that George Washington was a fisherman, right? And he probably had one of the first profitable fishing companies in the United States going back to 1793. Since we're in a congressional room, you'll also know that it was he utilized that fishery as a means to negotiate with a lot of the people across the aisle, right? So there's all sorts of opportunities in Asian carp. And for us, what we are really looking at and why I'm here today specifically is to really talk about the importance of supporting the leadership from the multitude of the different agencies that are in the room today. The single most important issue for us in this industry is really securing a sustainable source of the resources. You know, we have markets, and the market forces are able to give us the opportunities that are needed, and we're able to secure private industry capital. But we're placing a big bet that we have a sustainable supply chain. And there are a lot of customers that are willing, both domestically as well as foreign, to invest in this as a resource. But they're not willing to invest millions of dollars in new product creation if they're not sure that we can sustain a supply within the short term. So really the work that's being done by the agencies in terms of working with industry to make sure that we can sustain a supply is really critical. And beyond that, when you think about the impact that it's having, it's not really just an environmental impact. It's also really an economic impact. You know, we have created a lot of the processes are able to create maybe close to 100 jobs as soon as they open the door. And these are in communities that are fishing communities, right? These aren't just, you know, lost economic communities, but these are communities that have a long history of fishing, and they simply lost the opportunities to imports. And Asian carp, while it doesn't present a long-term, let's say, at least for as far as we know right now, we don't really know what the long-term might be, but it certainly produces a near-term opportunity for a lot of those communities. And I can tell you, you know, I often go around and I speak with a lot of our employees, and I speak with a lot of the community members, and they're thankful for the Asian carp, even though the newspapers report threat, invasive, nuisance. And so, you know, I really see this as not a story of an invasive species, but really it's a story of lemons to lemonade, right? If we work in terms of smart policy, and if we work with a mindset of understanding really what the opportunity is, and that, in fact, we're not trying to build a sustainable fishery with Asian carp. What we're trying to do is use it as an economic stimulus to revitalize an industry that was lost. That makes a lot of sense for us, and makes a lot of sense for a lot of people. There are some other things that I'll talk about a bit, because I think the right people are in the room. There are opportunities, obviously, that are beyond just domestic, which are also the export opportunities. We feel strongly that, you know, all processes across the U.S. can export Asian carp directly to China with no problem whatsoever. You know, we've pretty much validated the demand for that product in the market, and it can be done in a way that's profitable. But unfortunately, China has a pretty large domestic farm-raised carp industry. And therefore, the VAT taxes, the import duties, and everything being placed upon U.S. Asian carp makes it difficult to capitalize on those markets. So I don't know who's in this room that can help with that issue, but, you know, while I'm here, I want to just sort of bring it out as something that we really need support around, especially since duty and tax has been cut on most other popular seafood industries by China as of January 1st, 2017, with Asian carp excluded. And so we find that pretty ironic that's taking place. The last thing is I spoke a little bit in regards to some of the domestic opportunities. But again, I just really want to stress my purpose here today, and which is maybe a little bit unusual, is I don't really want anything from anyone in this room. We don't want money. We don't want incentives. We really just want you to support the agencies, because the agencies' work is really critical to the solvency of a lot of the business manufacturers that are investing in this area of management. And I do believe that over time, time will tell a very interesting story of how a problematic issue actually created an issue of economic growth. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. Okay, so my name is Greg Conover. I'm the coordinator for the Mississippi Interstate Cooperative Resource Association. And we'll see if the slides come back. I have them here. Okay. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to skim through my slides, because I do want to make sure that we have plenty of time for discussion at the end. And my purpose, I guess, here at the end was just to do two things. One was to focus in on the priorities that the Upper Mississippi River and the Ohio River Basin Partnerships, as well as MICRA at large, are looking at going into FY18 and the next couple, 3 years for the short term in their management control projects. And then also to highlight some of MICRA's priorities as we, MICRA's priorities moving forward. So as you heard from both Nick and Ron, the priority that the basins are looking at right now is preventing the further spread of Asian carp. That's our highest priority objective. And to do that, the focus is on limiting spread. And there's two key tools that the partnerships have really keyed in on. And those two tools, as you heard them both talk about today, are deterrence and commercial harvest, the physical removal of fish from the waters. Hey, it's coming up. Okay. So deterrents are very important to the partnerships, as Nick described. The idea of using deterrents kind of at the upper end and the lower end. It's hard to see the yellow areas here on the maps that are between the red and the blue, but that's kind of what we call the transitional zone. It's those areas between the areas of high abundance and then the areas where the fish are slowly moving into and increasing in numbers, and we don't have reproduction in what we call established populations yet. So within those reaches, if we can use deterrents to contain the population, those establish our management zones and where we focus actions. So those are some areas right now where the basins are looking, the basin partnerships are looking to work going into 2018 and beyond. As I said, locks and dams provide a lot of opportunities for the partnerships to focus in for these different deterrent technologies. One of the things that popped to mind is we have the electric dispersal barrier on the Chicago area waterway system, and that's one piece of an integrated control program to keep Asian carp from moving from Mississippi River Basin into the Great Lakes. And that's generally the same concept here, that the partnerships are using deterrents on the Ohio and Upper Mississippi River Basins. Is using deterrents is just one piece of an integrated control program, but it's a very important piece to allow them to contain the population and then focus their management efforts on the other tool that they're looking at right now, and that is physical removal. And while we have USGS and other entities that are doing research into different tools that can be used to reduce the populations, physical removal through commercial harvest is really the only tool that's readily available. So right now the focus is on commercial harvest for the immediate need to prevent dispersal. And again, Nick did a nice job describing how that's focused in that transitional zone to try and fish the populations down and prevent them from reproducing. And then also immediately below that, those areas in the red, fishing down the population to lower numbers so that you have fewer fish trying to move from that area of high concentration to areas of lower abundance. Okay, I said I was going to go fast, so I need to start moving. The other area that the MICRA and the partnerships are focusing in on is monitoring. Now, a lot of times monitoring seems to get a bad response from folks. So I just wanted to talk briefly about the importance of monitoring for evaluating success. And it's monitoring is fundamental to these control programs and to enable the biologists out there to understand how the fish and the populations are responding to the different management control actions. So they need the data, annual data, to be able to establish baseline data and trend data and see how those different actions are impacting the population over time. They need things like population data on the fish. Ron talked about telemetry. All of those are different important pieces of information that go into building models that help us make informed decisions with all these different pieces of information. And that modeling is important because it helps us look at what we've accomplished, how that population is responding, and how we need to be adaptive. What changes do we need to make going into the next year? So we're looking at multiple years of work, and we want to reflect after each year and see what small changes need to be made, or large changes if that be the case. But all of that in an effort to maximize our efficiency and to be as effective as we can with the resources that are being invested into management and control. Okay, the other point I wanted to make is to touch on MICRA's priorities. And I've got a slide here with a picture of the Mississippi River Basin on it. It has the Upper Mississippi River shaded in dark green. The Ohio River Basin is in the lighter yellow. But what I want to point out is that the Missouri River Basin in orange off to the left side of the screen and the lower Mississippi River Basin and the lighter green, those are all connected sub-basins within the Mississippi River Basin. So MICRA's approach has been to address management and control at a basin-wide scale. So they've been working with each of these different sub-basin groups to develop and implement framework, those control strategy frameworks, like what's taking place with the Ohio and Upper Mississippi River basins. Again, they're comprehensive plans, they're integrated, they're multi-year plans. The other important piece that MICRA is working on is improving communication, coordination, and collaboration across all of those regional partnerships in the Mississippi River Basin, but also with the Great Lakes Basin, which is also shaded there in light green as well. All of these waters are connected, so to them it's very important that we all work together, look for opportunities to leverage our knowledge and our capabilities, and really address the issue on a not just a basin-wide, but on a national scale. Okay, with that, I just want to point you to a couple different resources where you can get more information. The report to Congress that Aaron mentioned will be posted on AsianCarp.us. Past year's reports are there. Also, the other report that's on the screen there is the monitoring response plan for Asian carp in the Mississippi River Basin. That document, it's an annual document that MICRA produces with the sub-basin partnerships, and it has more details about the projects of those partnerships and what they're doing each year with the funding that they receive. The new monitoring response plan for 2017 will be posted online here in September as well. MICRA at micrarivers.org, that's the email address for MICRA. You're welcome to send questions to that email address. Those go to both myself, the coordinator, and to Ron as the chair, and we'd be happy to answer questions and open up a dialogue with anybody. And with that, we're going to have a little bit of time here anyway for questions and some discussion. And I just want to thank everybody for your time, for being here today, for your interest, and for your support of these interagency collaborative efforts to manage and control Asian carp. I want to point out that we have representatives from Illinois DNR, Corps of Engineers, and USGS in the room with us, and we're all happy to entertain your questions. So I'm going to turn it over to Joe to kind of moderate the question and answer.
Okay, so we welcome any questions that you may have. Yeah?
So, first of all, thanks for putting this panel together. We really appreciate the work you guys are doing on this. With the recent release of the Brandon Road Lock and Dam study, it's my understanding that it's 4 years out before the tentative proposal would begin to be implemented, and it would take about 4 years to implement that plan. So we're looking 8 years out. Considering the movement of various types of Asian carp, would that time frame allow us to prevent the movement of Asian carp into the Great Lakes River Basin?
Okay, so just to repeat the question for the recording for everybody, is the timeline in the Brandon Road study sufficient to stop the spread of Asian carp into the Great Lakes? Who would...
I think Kevin Irons is here. He's on top of that.
Great question. I'll try to answer it quickly. I'm not going to speak to the report. I'll let the Army Corps of Engineers do that. It is a tentative plan. But I'll give you the status, is that Asian carp have been below Brandon Road for about 26 years when they first appeared in 1991. And we've since, by deploying what we've talked about here, commercial efforts, we've reduced the population below Brandon Road. You know, between 55 and 75% is where the area, about 68% average relative abundance. So we're not counting every fish, but we're using hydroacoustics to do that. So we have not seen the advancement, and in fact, just the opposite. And we have not seen them, you know, move farther up into the, you know, beyond those electric barriers or the fences that exist farther upstream. So we're interested to see how this plan develops, but we're using these tools to affect the population currently.
Yes?
You guys mentioned a lot about telemetry use. Can you give a little bit of background on, like, how long the telemetry use has been occurring, and if there are, like, if you catch a fish in, like, a certain pool that's sort of on the edge, is that a fish that you automatically will not tag and put back in? Because I think for some folks, it's a little disconcerting to hear that Asian carp getting pulled out and some of them be tossed right back into the water. So if you can address that.
So at least for the Upper Mississippi system started to be putting in about 2013. So Minnesota put one in, Missouri put one in around Lock and Dam 19. I think the universities were putting them in the Illinois River. And in 2014, with Fish and Wildlife Service money, we started connecting all those systems. So now, like in the Ohio River Valley, and I talked about this last year, we have a connected system all the way from below Lock and Dam 19 all the way up into Minnesota. To your second question, we're on the leading edge. And just this past year, our legislature gave us authorization to tag and release fish back in. And you hit upon the concerns of people. But we are taking a conservative approach to begin with, at least. We feel that the information that you can gain from these fish is really valuable. When we catch our isolated cases right now, we know that the fish was there at that time. We don't know where it was before that, and we can't do that with telemetry. We don't know where it would go after that. And we've had cases where we're like, wonder where it would go. What triggered it to come to there? And this information will allow us to gather it. And we just tagged our first big head carp and released it here in July and have been tracking it every week to see that those movement patterns, with hopes that it'll lead us to new locations or give us insights of to what triggers it. And then ultimately our hope is if, and it's a big if, there are other carp in the area, there are social fish that will lead us to them. So when we go to recapture this fish, we can get those too.
In the Ohio River, we've had this debate as to when is a good time to not let fish go. We do use them as Judas fish, like Nick was talking about, to find other fish, so that's kind of important. But when you get up in the areas where we have so few fish, like in the Greenup Pool and above, we tend not to try to release transmitted fish there. Meldal and Don, we would release transmitted fish. So it just depends on where they're caught and how close to the leading edge they are. In the Ohio River, it was about the same time frame. We started about 2013. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came in after they discovered that we were doing it, making an effort to remove fish in that area. They came in with telemetry, the hydroacoustics, and a lot of other things. So about the same time frame.
Yeah. And I would just add that those are pretty much in a state of continual improvement and filling out, because there's a lot of gaps in those systems, so each year we've improved upon those systems to get better information.
Yeah.
This might be partially a question for USGS, but I know there's been a lot of work on reproduction areas of grass carp specifically in the Lake Erie Western Basin there. Have you found, and maybe you mentioned this in there, have you found any reproducing grass carp populations in the Upper Mississippi or Ohio River basins? And if so, how are they compared to thick-headed silver?
I know in our larval toes and stuff, they found some Asian carp in the or grass carp in the Meldal pool, larvae, recently hatched fish. It wouldn't be surprising to see grass carp more well established further upriver. They've been really around along a little longer, and really no effort was initially put out there to try and keep them in check. So I wouldn't doubt that they are better established further up. So
in the Upper Mississippi, in Minnesota, we have a comprehensive program that looks for eggs and larval, and we haven't found any larval or egg grass carp in the Minnesota waters of the Mississippi. We know it's occurring further downriver, but that's an area where we need more data between the Minnesota border and that further southern Iowa region of exactly where that front might be.
So is there no data on grass carp or just any Asian carp in general? There's not enough of that data.
Oh, just grass carp. We have good data on big head and silver in that area and black lower down.
We put out a call for data on juvenile grass carp data about 2 years ago, and there was very little information out there. The state's just not something that they had targeted and collected in the past. So grass carp have been in the system since the 70s, and they just didn't target that juvenile data. So that's something new that they're working on, working on collecting.
Okay, thank you.
We don't seem to get the abundances of grass carp like you do the big pulses of silver and big heads. So that's probably made them less noticeable, and maybe there's been less focus on them in the past. So,
well, I guess my main thing is diploid versus triploid. If there's only triploids that are out there, then they wouldn't be reproducing. But if there's more of a presence of reproduction, that means diploids are getting in there that shouldn't be there. So where are they coming from? And I guess that's the data gap is where you're going to
come from. Okay.
So to touch on that just a little bit, the history of grass carp and grass carp use in the U.S. is different than the other species. So there's quite a few years of stocking grass carp in the 70s when they only stocked them as diploids. So they were stocked far and wide across the U.S. I think 46 states had received grass carp by like 1974. And it wasn't until the early 1980s, around 1982, when they started using triploid grass carp. So we have diploid grass carp in the Mississippi River system. We know they're reproducing. We just don't have detailed data on the like reproductive rates and exactly where we're getting larval and juveniles. But that's not to say that the triploid system that's in place hasn't worked. It's just we had diploids stocked out there before we started using triploids. So you have two different management approaches overlapped in time, and a lot of times we hear that something's not working because there's diploids, but just to be clear that we had the diploids out there before we started using the triploids. So I think it would be a lot worse situation now if we hadn't been using triploids for the last three decades or more.
Right.
Just one question. Actually, I have about three questions. One of them is compared to the first time about 4 years ago, Ron, when we were talking about this, and when we first started allowing this work to be done on the Upper Mississippi and Ohio River, what advancement has there been any advancement in like permanent populations in the Ohio River?
Right. The question is, has there been any advances of established populations up the Ohio River? And Aaron pointed out early in his presentation was that one fish was found 60 miles further up.
Yeah.
That's occurring. We know that.
Sure.
To your question, as far as reproducing or recruiting populations, what our data shows really is that is not happening right now. That we really do believe that the effort that we're putting out there is stemming the tide of that. And as long as we don't see, our telemetered fish all of a sudden make a big move up, as long as all the monitoring we're doing in several pools every year shows the same thing in relative abundances, we're pretty sure that that's not happening. So.
All right. And I asked also, I guess I have two-part question, but also to see where we're coming from on it. I work for Congressman Kelly. He obviously represents Pennsylvania, and there are no Asian carp in Pennsylvania, and we want to keep it that way. And so that's basically where we came in. We never wanted to see Asian carp getting up in the Pittsburgh
right.
area. But at the same time, it's one of the most important transportation routes, to the to our Pennsylvania's economy.
Right.
All those locks and dams on the river. So we wanted to be able to stem this tide without interrupting or interfering in any way with, the barge industry and the industry that uses that river. So how do you guys, have you seen any trouble with that? We never want to see, a lock or dam, shut down.
Right.
Or interruption in that.
No, and we haven't seen an expansion at all so far. And the stuff that Kevin Irons and his group is doing on the Illinois River really has shown that with an increased effort of removal of these fish in the leading edges, it does kind of remove the impetus for these fish want to move further upriver.
Sure.
Because they've got the forage they need. If the habitat's there, they need. There's really less impetus for them to move up in mass. So,
the other, how do we balance? I want to see a commercial, fishery, the private-public partnership was something that we wanted to see from the beginning. The balance of trying to, when your goal is eradication, but also balancing that with having to, you know, once a demand's there, keep a supply available. Like,
right.
How do we balance that? Is there
number one, the industry itself would have to expand to such a level that we can't even imagine right now to do that. I believe in Illinois they did a study where it, in the Illinois River system, they would have to harvest 70% of the population a year to have any effect on the overall numbers or abundance in that river system. Because of recruitment, as you fish these things down, and we saw this in Kentucky Lake recently, as we started fishing these things down at a higher level, all of a sudden, boom, a big year class comes out. And so it would take a tremendous amount of effort to get there. That's why when you hear us talk about Asian carp control more than eradication, because it's just not feasible right now. And so what we can do, though, we can pick our battles. In the upper Miss, it's where they're working to keep them from going further up. In the Ohio River, it's the Greenup Pool, where I said it was a leading edge. Those are where our main battles are right now. Keep them from going up with more effort. If we were able to put more effort into it, we could probably do what Kevin's seeing a little more of in the Illinois River, where we could start fishing them down and backing that leading edge down. And in Kentucky waters, that means down to the McAlpin Lock and Dam. We could foresee, if enough pressure was put on those fish, that leading edges could move down to the McAlpin Dam, and then it would take quite a bit more effort because of the numbers of fish there.
Okay. Yep. Wanted to just weigh in a little bit, too. So, Ron is right with that, commercial fishing is a tool that we're using right now. There are other tools that we're using as well as part of an integrated approach, and as well as tools that we're developing. So partners like USGS and others are developing tools that will help give us more tools in that toolbox that will help us get towards eradication. I mean, eradication remains the ultimate goal of the overall national plan, but to get there, we don't have all the tools we need. Commercial fishing can help with that in some regard. Some of the other work that we're doing helps with that as well in terms of trying to find the leading edges and trying to find spawning concentrations and watching where these things are. But gear development and tool development and service is doing some of that work. USGS is doing the bulk of it. All of those tools will hopefully allow us to get to a place where eradication, which, like I said, which is the overall goal of that national plan, is a reality.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to level set when I spoke about having a consistent supply. We're not really talking about finding ways to grow the abundance. You can be sure we're not going to throw back any fish. That's guaranteed. But what we're really talking about is working with local agencies to make sure that we have a harmonized approach to being able to actually get the fish, right? So to make sure that we're operating in a way that complies with the existing regulations, but at the same time makes it economically efficient for us to operate. So that's really what we're looking at when we're looking at consistency of supply.
Yeah. One of the things that Andre touched on when he was talking was that the goal of these processors is not to be single-minded in what species they're working with. When these fishermen go out into these reservoirs and rivers and catch fish, they don't just harvest Asian carp. And we don't want them to. Actually, there's a lot of native species that we would like to see harvested down because they're rough fish and they can have the same effect on sport fishing populations, as do the Asian carp. So we welcome the fact that they're going to be diversified. So in the unlikely event that the next 30, 50 years that Asian carp start getting harvested down, these guys are going to be diversified enough that they can actually help us in other areas that need to be, where fish need to be fished down. So,
if I could just add from an Illinois perspective for the Mississippi and our waters that we manage, commercial harvest is really important. And we don't want to strike the eradication, but sea lamprey control in the Great Lakes is they're spending about $40 million annually on a fish that have very unique qualities, and that eradication is, that we're making a difference, but it's not eradication. Things change. So models we're working with the Fish and Wildlife Service and Southern Illinois University show harvesting these places where there are great abundances will help us manage those leading edges. And that's the next tier. We can focus on the leading edge currently, but we have to partner with these people that are removing larger numbers that will incrementally or exponentially help us at the leading edge.
We're starting to go over, but I think we'll have time for one more quick question. So,
sure. Can you just briefly expand on the FY18 priorities and how they differ from previous years, or study levels is the goal.
So the question was, how do the FY18 priorities differ from? So what you heard the gentleman present today was what is happening with the FY17 priorities. FY18 planning is starting in October, so we haven't actually set those specific projects. But what we do know is that through our conversations, through FY17 planning, and then through this year as projects have been implemented, that the partnerships are interested and keen in on those specific tools of deterrence and commercial harvest, putting more emphasis there, as well as on the monitoring and assessment aspect, so that we can evaluate those actions. So those, from the broad spectrum of projects that they've worked on for the last 3-4 years as a collaborative effort, they're keen in on those different tools right now to really try and focus in on containing the populations and limiting that upstream spread. But the details still remain to be worked out. We'll be meeting in October to set those plans in place.
All right, so I think that'll do it. Thank you, everyone, for coming out today, and thank you again to our speakers and everyone who helped organize this briefing.
And we'll be here for a while if they have other questions.
Yeah, and they'll be here for a little while if you have any further questions you'd like to talk about. Thanks.